learn the continue on in the idea of what the Mishnah Sharim spoke about. One of the things that prevent a person from really being seriously considerate of Yiddishkeit is the hashpas hasviva, the environmental influences. So I want to speak more about that. Last time, we just got to finish on time. We have a chasm to get to, so not mine. Okay. Last time we discussed the source of the Rambam. The Rambam says that a person is affected or influenced by his environment by nature. It's something part of the nature of a person, and therefore you can't escape it. It has to happen. It's like putting your hand into fire. It has to make an impression. And we said, where did the Rambam know that from? And we said the Gemara in Ksubas, that you're allowed to say that a Kala is not the Hasuda, even if on the surface you don't think that, because since people are affected by how other people think, and the Chosin obviously thinks she is a Kala no the Hasuda, or he wouldn't be marrying her, then somewhere in your psyche there is a place where you also have that same feeling, because you're influenced at least in some way by what he thinks, and therefore you're allowed to say it. So it's not a lie. That's how we learn that that Migdal Oz, who says that that's the source of the Rambam. Okay, so now that we know that it is a fact of nature that people are influenced, what does that mean? Does that mean that if you live amongst people who are bad influences, you are going to become like them? We know that that's not the case. Plenty of people who live amongst bad influences, and they don't seem to become like the people they live like, they live amongst. So what does it mean that it's something that has to happen? If it has to happen, then it should be very evident. So a few ideas. Start with a Michtav Eliyahu. It says, the Medrash says on the pasuk Vayoel Moshe Loshevis Asaish. Vayoel means to start, but it also means to take an oath, Allah. And the Medrash says that when Moshe began to live with Yisrael, who at this time was not yet from, not yet Jewish, he was an Oved Avodah Zarah, he was still checking out all the different idols of the world. He was on his search, and therefore Moshe Rabbeinu agreed to live in the home of Yisro. Now his wife, he influenced obviously to believe in God or whatever. That's how he married her. But his father-in-law and probably mother-in-law were not of the same mind. So it says when Moshe began to live with Yisro, he took an oath that the first child they would have would be given over to Avodah Zarah. So the Medrash says. And in the end, Moshe Rabbeinu's child, Taka, had a connection to Avodah Zarah. It wasn't Mamash Avodah Zarah, but he was the Levi who ministered to Pesel Micha. So the obvious question is, how in the world can Moshe Rabbeinu take an oath that he's willing to have his first child given over to Avodah Zarah? Right, it's mind-boggling to say such a thing about Moshe Rabbeinu. So the Michtam Eliyahu explains it in the following way. Others say very simply that Moshe Rabbeinu never had intention to do that, and he basically led Yisro on that was what he was swearing, but it wasn't really the case. He never took such an oath that his child would go to Avodah Zarah, but he led Yisro to believe that in order that he could marry the daughter or whatever, which was permissible.
Did he swear in the name of Hashem?
What?
Did he swear in the name of Hashem?
Did he swear in the name of Hashem? I don't know. That doesn't say. Even if he did, he didn't lie, and that Yisro misunderstood the Shvuah. I think the Radvaz says that. And I guess whatever it was, that's maybe the simple meaning. The Mechel Melel says no. What it means is the following. Whenever it says that somebody took an oath, it doesn't mean that they swore openly. An oath is just a symbol, a sign, that a person made up his mind to do something ironclad. And usually you know that only if the person took an oath. But if somebody decided something ironclad, then it's as if he took an oath. So many times when Chazal say he took an oath, it doesn't mean literally he swore something. It means he made up his mind. He decided something as strong as if it would be an oath. Meaning the following. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he agreed to live in Yisro's home, he knew that the possibility was there, since influence is a very strong thing, that Yisro's influence would be stronger than his influence. Now he knew that he could counteract Yisro's influence for himself and for his wife, but his children he wasn't sure. And he knew that there was a risk. He was hoping that it wouldn't happen, that he and his wife's influence would overpower Yisro's influence. But he knew that it was a possibility. So when Moshe Rabbeinu made the decision to stay with Yisro, knowing that there was a possibility that Yisro's influence would make his child an avodah zara, take his child away to avodah zara. So when he made that decision, it's as if he took an oath that that's okay with him. Just putting himself in that situation was tantamount to agreeing to giving his son over to avodah zara. He was hoping it never would happen. He was hoping that he would be able to influence his son more than Yisro would influence his son. But he knew it was a possibility, and when he made the decision to stay with Yisro, he knew that he was accepting that possibility also. Just as if he took an oath that his child would go to avodah zara. That's something, therefore, from there.
Was that a mistake?
What? Was it a mistake? I don't know if he had a choice. But tantamount, the Chori didn't have a choice. There was no other Eitzah, right? He was a fugitive. Couldn't go back to Egypt. Right? So he had no other choice, but he knew that this was tantamount. Making this decision was tantamount to agreeing to such a thing on the occasion, on the side that would happen. What do we learn from this? That just putting yourself in a situation where you could be influenced is already a negative thing. Right? Sometimes you can't avoid it. But just putting yourself, even if you hope it won't happen, and you're doing everything in your power, shouldn't happen. But since there's a possibility that will, being in a situation like that is already negative.
Is there a story about how one of the avots or someone protected themselves from the influence?
Yeah, we'll get to that. That's coming, not tonight, but eventually. First, let's see what the influence is, and then we'll see how you protect yourself from it. Okay, so that's one aspect. One aspect is putting yourself in a situation where you could be influenced is already a negative thing, even if nothing happens. But just accepting the fact that you know that it could happen, that in itself is a negative thing. So first, second thing. The influence doesn't happen all at once. You don't move in around people who are Mechal Shabbos and the next week you're going to be Mechal Shabbos. That obviously is not the way the influence works. But the Gemara says on the Pasuk, Ashri Ha'ish Asher Lo Holach Ba'atzas Rishayim U'Vederech HaTayim Lo Omad U'Vamoshev Leitzim Lo Yosha. Fortunately, the person who didn't walk with Rishayim and stand with sinners and sit in a Moshev Leitzim. So the Gemara says it starts with walking, and then you stand, and then you sit. Meaning, everything goes Bahadraga, it goes slowly, and Hadraga means stage by stage, in stages.
Gradually
and in stages. Meaning, the influence starts very, very subtle. And then it gets more, and then it gets more, and eventually it leads to more serious and more serious things. Again, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to end up being Mechal Shabbos. But what it means is the following. One idea is that you lose your sensitivity. Okay? A person who was brought up, let's say, in Mea Shearim, and never went out of that neighborhood. Today I don't even know if it applies there. But let's a very insulated, environment. They never saw a Jew be Mechal Shabbos. Never. Never heard of it. All the Jews they know are Shomer Shabbos. So if that person would see Chil Shabbos by a Jew, it would affect him terribly. He would probably, faint on the spot. How could a Jew be Mechallel Shabbos? Right. On the other hand, somebody brought up in the environment most of us were brought up in, right, where if you see a Jew who is Shomer Shabbos, it's a big deal, right? So we're not affected that much if somebody's Mechallel Shabbos, right? That's like taken for granted. You could make yourself more sensitive by putting yourself in a good environment, or creating, we'll see later on, your own insulated environment. But the Maisa, the way what a person sees around him either makes him more or less sensitive to what's going on. And therefore, the putting yourself in a bad environment, you may not become a Mechallel Shabbos. You may be 100% Shomer Shabbos, but your appreciation of Shabbos, your appreciation of how serious it is to be Mechallel Shabbos, how important it is to keep Shabbos, is going to be affected. And you're not going to be as careful. And that's what the Mesillas Yesharim says. One of the things that makes a person less careful about mitzvahs is being in a bad environment. Because if you see around you people doing this all the time, you can't really feel that it's something very serious, because it's something you see all the time. If you never see it, right, then to you it's something that's unusual and is something that's very negative. So one influence is the gradual, that you may not change your actions at all, but you are less sensitive to how serious they are. That's one effect. And that's a serious effect. You may not even see any difference in action, but it's an attitude. Then there's a second thing. And that is based on what the Michta Melio says, how people have free choice. We all have free choice, but our free choice is not on the same level. There's called the Nekuda Sabechira. Okay? He explains with this the sins of great people. Why the Torah considers for sin, for instance, says that Reuven violated his father's wife. But he didn't really live with her. All he did was move the bed around, right? When Leah died, when Rachel died, so he thought that his mother now should take the place in Yaakov's bedroom of the main wife. And instead, Yaakov moved in Bilhah's bed. So Reuven thought that was an affront to his mother. So he moved the bed out. And it's considered like he lived with his father's wife. So Michta Melio says, L'maisa, why didn't the Torah just say, move the bed, tell us what he did. Don't tell me something terrible that he did that sounds like really that the most bummy person wouldn't do, right? And says, Reuven did such a thing? Right? And he really didn't do that, so why did the Torah say he did it? So similarly with David HaMelech, really the circumstances around Bathsheba was that she was 100% mutter to David. She wasn't a married woman. Their husband had given her a divorce when he went out to battle. So legally, what he did was 100% right. And yet the Torah says that portrays it as if he lived with a married woman, committed adultery, which wasn't true halachically. So why did the Torah present it like that? And so on, so many places where the Torah says things about great people that they did really terrible things and they didn't. So why did the Torah tell us they did? So he explains the following. Everybody has the place that they're judged on. He says that the fight with the Yetzer Hara is like a war. In every war, there's the land you've conquered, there's the land the enemy has conquered, and the war takes place on no man's land, neither of you have conquered, and that's where you're fighting. He says every person has things that the Yetzer HaTov has conquered. They become a mimic by the person. They're already something that he's used to, and their habit. And you don't even think about it. You don't have a Yetzer Hara and a Yetzer HaTov fighting, right? A person with Shomer Shabbos doesn't get up every Shabbos morning and say, should I drive to shul today or should I walk? He's already in the custom, the habit of walking. He doesn't even think about driving on Shabbos. Not something that even comes into his mind. So that's already conquered for the Yetzer HaTov. Then there are certain things that the person may not even think about. He thinks about his business on Shabbos, doesn't even think about it. It's already a habit for the bad. And then there's the areas that he knows are wrong, and it's hard for him to do, and he has the Yetzer Hara saying, do it, and the Yetzer HaTov say, don't do it, or vice versa, and that's where his Bechira, that's where his free choice is. And the things that are already habitual, one way or the other, he doesn't really have free choice. Right? even though theoretically he does, but actually there's no real free choice over there. And everybody's nekudas habechira, everybody's place of free choice is different. Right? For instance, somebody who's a new Baal Tshuva may get up Shabbos morning and have to have a fight whether he should drive or not. So for him, that's the place where his Yetzer Hara and Yetzer HaTov fight over Shabbos, by driving. But he already may have gotten into the habit of not smoking on Shabbos. So for him, the smoking is already conquered for the good. Or maybe just the opposite. He still smokes on Shabbos, he's just given up driving. But smoking, he hasn't given up yet. So that's conquered for the good, or this is where there's the Yetzer Hara, whatever. Everybody's level is different. And everybody is judged be'ikar on two things. One is how much you have made the good as a habit, and you'll get rewarded for that. How much you've made the bad for a habit, and you'll get punished for that. But the major reward and punishment on any specific moment of free choice is in those areas that are no man's land, that haven't been habitual one way or the other way. For the habit, you'll get the reward for making it a habit for the good, or punished for making it a habit for the bad. But on an ongoing basis, you're not going to get the same reward and punishment for the individual actions, which are anyway habitual, one way or the other. Where are you going to get the major reward and punishment? In those areas where you have to make a conscious choice. And therefore he says that really all the Averas are the same Avera, just on different levels of free choice. For instance, a person who's on a very low level may think that it's okay to shoplift. He has all these reasons why stores anyway take that into consideration when they make their prices, that there's a certain percentage of people shoplifting. So basically you're paying for it anyway, what's it called, so might as well take it. And stores don't lose anything, maybe they're insured. You have all different kinds of reasons why shoplifting is okay. So a person has already conquered, his Yetzer Hara has conquered that, and the guy shoplifts. But he knows that robbing banks are not a proper thing. So, but that already, has a fight with his Yetzer Hara. Sometimes his Yetzer Hara tells him, go rob the bank, and sometimes says, no, it's not right. And so waking somebody up and stealing their sleep is not even in his lexicon. He doesn't even understand that's called stealing. Or stealing somebody else's ideas. That's beyond him completely. Right? So, maybe what's it called, in the air, and what's it called, armed robbery, though, going rob with a gun, that he wouldn't do. Because he knows he wants to go wrong to murder. So, and putting himself in a situation may kill somebody, that he doesn't do. So, his Yetzer HaTov has conquered armed robbery. His Yetzer Hara has conquered shoplifting and stealing other people's ideas or whatever. And the place where he has Bechira is robbing banks. You have another person who, he already knows you don't rob banks, you don't arm rob. He's already in the habit of not doing that. But shoplifting is where his Yetzer Hara is. Right, and for him, not stealing other people's ideas or whatever is also beyond him. That's already something that the Yetzer Hara has conquered. So his area of Bechira is in shoplifting. Somebody else may have a much higher Madrega. Him, the Yetzer HaTov, has conquered almost everything. He doesn't rob banks, he doesn't arm rob, he doesn't shoplift. For him, cheating on his income tax may be the place where his Yetzer Hara kicks in. But steals people's ideas and wakes people up. That's also not in his lexicon. Somebody on a higher Madrega, his Bechira may be on waking people up, and all the other things he by habit doesn't do. But waking people up or stealing their ideas, that may be where his Bechira is. Now, somebody who's on the higher Madrega and wakes somebody up, and knows that it's wrong and he wakes them up. And somebody on the lower Madrega who shoplifts, and somebody on the other Madrega who goes and robs the bank, basically they're all doing the same thing. What sin are they over? Stealing. Except stealing has many, many degrees to it. But the free choice of the person is the same for all of them. Each one knows this is stealing, and I know that it's wrong, I know that I shouldn't be doing it, and I have to decide what to do. So the one who shoplifts, if he makes a decision to shoplift, he's stealing. The one who wakes somebody up on his level, that's stealing. The one who, robs the bank on his level, that's stealing. That is, and therefore all of them are on their level, transgressing the prohibition of stealing on their level. So if a person on a very high level and stealing for him is waking somebody up, if he wakes somebody up, how's the Torah going to describe it? Not that he woke somebody up. That's not the sin. The sin is stealing. On his level, he knows that's stealing. And when he made the decision to wake the person up, right, and not be careful that to not to steal their sleep, he is over on stealing, just as much as the person who robbed the bank. So this is commensurate to his level, this is his level. Therefore, when the Torah says that David did what he did, on his level, right, when it says not to commit adultery, it means not to be immoral on any level. So somebody who immorality is actually committing an act is one thing. For other people, their level of immorality is very subtle. But it's the same sin. So the same sin that for a regular person would be having relations with his father's wife, moving the bed on Reuven's level, is the same sin. It's a degree, a subtle degree of immorality, which is included in that sin of losinah, of committing adultery. The worst thing is the actual deed, but there's many, many levels that fall into that same prohibition. And somebody on a higher level, so for them, the prohibition is done by moving the bed. And therefore the Torah didn't mince words. It didn't say move the bed. It said, it called a spade a spade. On his level, that was tantamount to committing adultery on our level. So the Torah said it in a way that we'd understand it. That's how the Mishnah Maleo explains this thing, therefore. When a person is bouncing ball, right, wherever it is, where your free choice is, so you could be three levels away from the actual sin. Right? A person on a high level can be 10 levels away from actually committing adultery, 9 levels away from doing something that's not mamish adultery, but more of an immoral actions, 7 levels away from speaking in an immoral way, which is the next level down, right, and so on. And if you do things that make your level different, you're getting closer to doing the sin. You may not ever do the sin, but you're one step closer. Till now, you were 8 levels away from the real serious sin. And now you're only 7 levels away because of the influence of the people around you. So if you live with people around you that are doing things that are terrible, right, it may not affect you to do terrible things, but it'll bring you one step closer. It will alter where you are. In other words, if you never saw Chilul Shabbos, so to you, Chilul Shabbos is an impossibility. It's impossible for a Jew to be in Chilul Shabbos. So you're so far removed from Chilul Shabbos that it's already like 10 levels removed. But if you see people being Mechal Shabbos all the time, so it becomes in the realm of possibility. You won't do it, but it's possible to do it. So you're already one step closer to doing it. It's not an impossibility. It's a possibility that you wouldn't do, but it's already a possibility. So you've changed your level, even though it doesn't appear anything different. You're the same Shomer Shabbos you were last week, but already your mice have changed. Because last week you were 10 levels away from Chilul Shabbos, this week you're only 9 levels away. Because now it's, last week it was an impossibility for you to imagine somebody being Mechal Shabbos. Now it's possible to imagine it. It's within the realm of possibility, yeah.
What does it add to a mitzvah if you struggle in order to attain it? Like you're doing the mitzvah to keep Shabbos, but let's say it's this struggle.
There's no mitzvah to put yourself in, God will give you the struggles. A person's not allowed, supposed to look for nisyonos.
No, I'm asking you, if you're doing the struggle,
yeah,
and it's the choice of Bechira, what does it add? You're doing the mitzvah, does it add something to the mitzvah that it's on the level of free will or not?
Yeah, because you get rewarded according to the difficulty of what you're doing. Okay.
So the whole time, Rose was explaining how a person doesn't just start things something extreme because the influence is just subtle changes. Rose mentioned that is the type of change, but it could be the more extreme also.
Usually isn't. Usually we don't find people who live around people who steal and they themselves become robbers in the end. It's not a mitzvah, right? You live in a city and there's a lot of ganavim, right? So you should be a ganav. And most people don't become ganavim. But lamaisa, these other things do apply. We're saying is...
Over time
people don't become ganavim. And over time, if you live amongst Mechal Shabbos, you're not going to be Mechal Shabbos. It's not Messias, right? That's not what it means that the influence is for sure and it's going to happen. It doesn't happen necessarily. Right? In fact, most of the time it doesn't happen to such an intense degree. But it happens in these things, which are just serious, serious.
I'm just saying,
it rarely happens. It rarely happens. You don't find people who are from people who, either people who are outstanding and don't steal, that they're going to end up stealing because people around them steal. Right? It doesn't happen. And you don't find people who are Shomer Shabbos that move to a place where there are people around them Mechal Shabbos that eventually become Mechal Shabbos. They can still keep Shomer Shabbos, be Shomer Shabbos. Shaila is what the intensity of their Shmir Shabbos is going to be. People live around murderers. There are murderers all over the place. Right? Don't become murderers, usually. Right? Usually, yeah, it could happen. But it's not the norm. The norm is that you're not influenced in the intense way that if you live amongst people who do terrible things, you're going to end up doing terrible things. But what the influence will be the subtle things. Not that it can't happen, it could happen. It does happen sometimes, but metzias-wise, it happens more rarely than the other kinds of influence.
Is the chutzah ra'ah they're talking about?
The what?
The yitzhar, this is the chutzah ra'ah, right?
Yeah.
That's what they say. Is that what they mean? I mean, that's something that's still...
Right. Well, the chutzah sa'ara means that it's a very subtle thing.
So that right. it enters in this way.
It starts with very subtle things. Yeah. But again, it doesn't necessarily progress to the most intense on a normal basis. But just the fact that the effect is subtle is terrible, because on a person's level, that's as if he would be Mechal Shabbos. Right, on his level, to do things that where he loses his sensitivity and his carefulness or whatever. Okay, so that is how it works. So now the question is, how do you protect yourself from that? So the Rambam says, move to a place where you won't have these influences. And if every place around the influences are there, go and live in the desert. Live alone. Don't have any connection with other people. Which is pretty much impossible also. Right? So, what do you do? So there's a Me'iri. The Me'iri says that the Rishoyim in this world are like the sea. They're ready to drown you. And the way to escape them is a boat. Now, on the surface, that doesn't make any sense, because you can't escape the sea in a boat. A boat can only float on the sea. He should have said the way to escape them is like an amphibious craft. Get an amphibious craft and get out of the water. So you're out. You're separated from the Rishoyim. The answer is you can't do that. There's no place to go. The waters are everywhere. So the most you can do is not isolate yourself from the Rishoyim, but insulate yourself from them. You're amongst them, but you're not with them. You're in a boat. The boat is waterproof and doesn't let the water in. That is how a person can avoid, he can live to himself. He has to create his own environment amongst the other environment, but not with it. Now, where do we see that? By Yosef, when they first went down to Mitzrayim, so obviously Mitzrayim was a very bad influence, did terrible things. So how in the world were they going to avoid being influenced? So it says that Yaakov, what was he impressed with when he saw the wagons that Yosef sent to bring him to Mitzrayim? He realized that Yosef was still okay, and it reminded him of the fact that they were learning the laws of Egla Rufa before he left, because he sent him a wagon. So we always ask that Lechora, it says Paro sent the wagons, not Yosef. So how in the world was it a hint that they were learning Egla Rufa? Because he sent them wagons, if Paro sent the wagons. So some say, the Medrash says, that the wagons that originally Paro sent were engraved with Avodah Zarah. And Yehuda burnt those wagons, and Yosef sent other wagons. So when Yaakov saw the wagons that Yosef sent, because the ones that Paro sent were burnt, then he realized that Yosef hinted to him Egla Rufa, which we'll get to in a second, doesn't make any sense, and that they were Yosef's wagons. The only problem is the Torah says not like that. Torah says when they went back in the wagons, they went in the wagons that Paro sent. So I thought Paro's wagons were burnt. how they go in charcoal. Secondly, even if Yosef sent the wagons, where was there a hint that they were learning Egla Rufa? Egla Rufa is that if somebody's murdered, you don't know who the murderer is, so you measure to the nearest city, and the basin of that city, the city brings a calf, and they behead it, and the Beis Din washes their hands over the calf and says, we didn't spill this blood, and that this should be a kapara until they find the murderer. So that was the last thing that Yaakov and Yosef were learning together, and he hinted it by sending the wagons, because the word egla is similar to the word agola. Agola is a wagon, and egla is a calf. So the hint was, I'm sending you a wagon to hint to you that we were learning about Egla Rufa. So that would make sense if there was no purpose of sending the wagon. First of all, Yosef wanted to hint to his father that they were learning Egla Rufa. Send him a calf, a little model calf, right? So don't send him a wagon, and he has to make the connection. Well, wagon sounds like Egla, so besides the fact, if he had sent him a wagon that had no purpose at all, Yaakov would say, why send me wagons? He said, well, wagon sounds like Egla, must be hinting me. That would make sense. But he sent him a wagon to move. It's like somebody sending somebody a moving truck to pick up their furniture because they're moving, and the guy says, oh, I get it, you're trying to hint to me I should have good luck, because truck lies at luck, and therefore it's good luck. No, I'm sending a truck because you need to move. What in the world is there any connection? So what is it? It makes absolutely no sense. Yosef sent the wagon, so where did Yaakov get that there's some kind of hint over here more than just the wagon? Therefore, I want to say the following. That originally, when Paro sent the wagon, why did he send wagons? So Paro tells Yosef, take wagons and bring your parents and your brothers and all of their family here in the wagons. And don't bring your furniture and kalim, right? Don't bring anything with you except your bodies. Why? Because when you come here, I will outfit you with the best of Egyptian stuff. So don't worry, make a yard sale, sell everything there, and come just with your bodies. Why did Paro say that? Because Paro assumed that Yaakov's an old man, and old people don't like to do new things. They don't like to move. They don't like to change their environment. And, you can't teach an old horse new tricks. So, and he wanted Yaakov to come to Mitzrayim. He wanted to entice him to come. So he figured a lot of the reason people don't like to come to new places, especially older people, is because they feel uncomfortable. They don't fit in. Right? You know, you come to Eretz Israel and your appliances are 110 and you have to put them in 220 sockets and burn them out, and you don't fit in, the furniture doesn't fit in the room, and the clothing is not the kind of clothing people wear here. So you feel uncomfortable. So he wanted to entice Yaakov to come. So he said, look, I'm going to make you really be able to fit in and assimilate into Mitzrayim culture easily. Don't worry about bringing anything with you. I'll outfit you in the best clothing, the best furniture, everything Egyptian. You'll fit in, you'll feel comfortable. That's how Paro thought he's going to entice Yaakov to come. Yosef knew, if he tells his father that, he'll never come in a million years. He doesn't want to assimilate into Mitzrayim. He wants to be guaranteed that they will never assimilate into Mitzrayim. So Yosef added wagons, and he sent wagons for all of their kalim, everything, the furniture, the clothing, everything. So when they came to Mitzrayim, they reconstructed a little Israel in the middle of Mitzrayim. Something like Matityahu. What's it called? A little America in the middle of Israel. Right? It's like an embassy. An embassy is the land that belongs to the host, to the country that has the embassy, and it happens to be amongst the host country. But the American embassy is American territory in the middle of Israel. They wanted to construct a little Eretz Israel in the middle of Mitzrayim and keep to themselves and not be assimilated. And in order to do that, they had to bring everything with them. So they were living in Eretz Israel, happened to be transposed in Mitzrayim. They weren't living with the Egyptians, like the Egyptians, only amongst the Egyptians. And Yosef knew that if he wouldn't send the wagons for everything, Yaakov would never come, unlike what Paro thought would entice Yaakov to come. So when Yaakov saw the wagons that Yosef sent, meaning the ones for everything, Paro only sent wagons for the people. And that in itself was tantamount to Avodah Zarah. Sending wagons only for the people with the intent that the people should come and they should assimilate is Avodah Zarah. When it says they burnt it, it doesn't mean they burnt it physically. It means they burnt it, they negated it by adding other wagons to bring everything with them. Now those wagons don't represent assimilation anymore. And they feel they went in the wagons of Paro sent, that was them. But their property went into the wagons that Yosef sent. And Yosef clearly said this to his brothers when they came. Two things. He said, I'm going to go tell Paro, Achayu Beisavi Asher Be'eretz Kedad Bo'elai. My brothers and family and their families who are in the land of Canaan came to me. Now that sentence doesn't make any sense. They can't be in the land of Canaan and have come to him. It should have said they are from the land of Canaan and came to me. Not Asher Be'eretz. And in fact, when they reported it to Paro, they said it differently. Achayu Beisavi Bo Be'eretz Kedad. They came from the land of Canaan. But to his brothers, he said, I'm going to tell Paro, my brothers who are in Canaan came to me. Meaning you didn't leave Canaan. You brought it with you. You brought a little bubble called Canaan. You're going to transpose it in amongst the Egyptians, but you're going to live in that little bubble. You're not going to live with the Egyptians, you're going to live amongst them, like a boat on the water. And therefore, it says, when Yosef introduced his brothers to Paro, he told them to tell Paro the following. He said, he coached them. He said, when Paro asks you what you do for a living, say blank. Why? Because the Egyptians abominate shepherds. They get sick to their stomach because shepherds take care of what they consider a god. And they take care of it as if it's an animal. Right? They believe in the sheep. So if you would not know what the Torah said, what would you assume Yosef told his brothers? Don't mention anything about ever being a shepherd. You don't know what shepherds are. You never saw sheep in your life, right? You never did shepherding. You were, what's it called, whatever you were, gas station attendants, you were not shepherds. Don't mention it. That's what you would imagine Yosef tell his brothers. You know what he told them? When Paro asks you what you do for a living, tell him that we're shepherds. Not only are we shepherds now, we always were shepherds. Not only were we always shepherds, but our parents and grandparents were always shepherds. We don't know anything else but being shepherds. And the Torah says, Leman Yeshu Be'eretz Goshen, in order that Paro should put you safely away in Goshen, Ki Toavas Mitzrayim Koroitzom, because the Egyptians abominate shepherds. Now, what kind of advice is that? The answer is, that's exactly what Yosef knew the brothers and his father wanted. We don't want to assimilate. So say you're shepherds, they'll keep you at arm's distance, you won't be able to mix in with them, and that's what they want. And the tsarists in Mitzrayim only started when they started to assimilate. They started going to the Egyptian circuses and theaters, and then the yeshivut started. As long as they remained separate, they, what's it called, that was fine. So they were in Mitzrayim, but they weren't with Mitzrayim. And that is the lesson of Egla Rufa. Why? How do we know that the last thing that Yaakov and Yosef were learning was Egla Rufa? Where Chazal had a Kabbalah? So the Balei HaTosfos say, very simple deduction, reasonable deduction. What was the last thing, the last contact? Yosef, Yaakov sent Yosef on a mission. The next, last thing is to say goodbye. And Yosef left and Yaakov started to escort him. So Yosef probably said, Dad, it's not important. Don't escort me. Don't bother. I know the way. Go home. And Yaakov said, no, it's very important to escort somebody. And Yosef said, yeah, how do you know that? He said, we learned from the parasha of Egla Rufa. Because why did the Sanhedrin, the Beis Din of that city, wash their hands over this calf and say they didn't spill the blood? Do we think that they're the murderers? But what they're saying is, we didn't see this guy who was murdered and let him go without giving him food and and an escort. The food, maybe if he was hungry and that's why he was too weak to fight off the murderer. And maybe if we would have given him an escort, he would have saved his life. Now the obvious question is, the escort, all you have to do is escort him to the city limit. Or 4 amas out of your house. You don't have to escort him to the next city. So if you escorted him to the city limit, he was killed somewhere later, was that going to help the escort? So the Maral says that a person who has a connection to other people is not a loner, and therefore he has more zechuyos, and he's harder to kill him because he has the zechus of other people connected to him. And therefore, even if you walk with the person just 4 amas, you create a spiritual connection. And you are where your mind is, not where your body is. And you went with that person now mentally. And that helps him. That's what we learn from Egla Ruf. So that was the last thing they were talking about. When Yosef sent the wagons for all of their furniture, he showed you, remember that lesson. You're not where you are physically. We're physically in Egypt, but our minds are still in Eretz Israel. And you taught me that a person can be where his mind is, not where his body is. So that was the whole picture. That's what Yaakov Avinu recognized, that Yosef is still in the fold. He understands these things. He doesn't want us to assimilate. He didn't assimilate. He had to live amongst the Egyptians, but not necessarily with them. That was the thrust of this thing, and that's what the Miri says. You sometimes, or many times, can't avoid, you can't isolate yourself from bad influences, for whatever reasons there are. You can't run away, it's impossible. But at most you can do is insulate yourself and live amongst, but not with. I always like to compare it. They have the artist's conception of a colony on the moon. So it's difficult, right? They're not going to be able to populate the moon if everybody has to walk around in spacesuits. Can't function like that. You can, you know, jump around a little bit and plant an American flag, right, and say one giant step for man, one small step for... but you can't, what's it called, you can't live a normal life like that. So what their conception is to have this bubble, which they have climate controlled, that they have somehow they make a gravity that's in that bubble, and oxygen, and you can live in that bubble as if you're on Earth. So you're on the moon, but you're not with the moon. You're in your self-contained bubble on the moon. That's how a person has to create a self-contained bubble amongst the negative things of the world. You're living in the world, but not with the world. Amongst, but not with. That's mamish like a boat on the water. How you do that, that we'll speak about next week. Oh, next week there's no shiur because of the Ben Moshe Chasana. And in 2 weeks we'll continue with this and see how you do that.